This is Talk Star Wars. The official podcast of TalkStarWars.co.uk. Hey everyone, welcome back to Talk Star Wars. I'm Mark.
And I am Rob.
And there's no one else. I did speak to Paul this week. I touched base with Paul this week. He just wanted to get caught up on what was going on around TSW because there's been a lot of changes, isn't there? And
yes, of course, yeah.
He, unfortunately, still not available for a couple of weeks to jump in, but there's a good chance in a couple of weeks' time he'll be back. He did mention sort of jumping in this evening, but timing wise, he thought it would probably be a bit too late. So I gave him a pass.
That's fair enough.
But yeah, hopefully we'll get him back in a couple of weeks. How are you doing anyway, mate? You all right?
I'm doing all right, yeah. I mean, I'm certainly having a better week this week than last week, because last week was a bit of a wrong one.
Although, it was rough for you, wasn't it?
I would like to take a minute to thank the people who reached out to me behind the scenes just to check I was okay.
Nice.
It was very much appreciated, very much not necessary, because, you know, without going into too much detail, the problem was not mine, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, I really do appreciate it. It's very, very touching to for people to reach out in that way and just kind of make sure I'm okay. Very, very kind indeed.
Yeah, very thoughtful community of people we are surrounded by.
It's true. They're all just lovely, aren't they?
Aren't they just? There's a couple of wrong ones in there, but we'll let them decide who they are.
I may not have met them yet. Who knows?
All right, we've got, I think we've got some really cool stuff coming up in this evening's show. But before we get to that, especially the voicemails, I'm really quite thrilled. Before we get to that, we've got some countdown. So at the time of recording, Solo is just 49 days away.
Nice.
And episode 9 is 622 days away.
Right.
That Solo movie is looming large now for us. Very, very exciting stuff.
Indeed.
We've got a new little section we're going to slip in here at the top this evening.
But first, I've
run a Twitter poll. I'd almost forgotten that we were running a Twitter poll this week. It was our pinned tweet for most of last week. And it was inspired by a comment from Mark Hamill about his preferred viewing order for Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And so I threw this out. I threw this tweet out there. It's pinned to our show notes. If you download the show notes, you'll get some insight into some of these bits and pieces.
Yeah.
So the tweet is as follows: which is your preferred Star Wars viewing order? Quote this tweet with your own special order or recommendation.
Okay.
So 7% of people would watch the movies 1 through 8 and then Rogue One at the end. Didn't really think that would get a lot of mileage.
No.
29% of those who took the time to vote said they would watch it in pretty much release order, which is 4 through 6, 1 through 3, 7 and 8, and then Rogue One.
Okay.
So, of course, 7 and 8 coming as a pair there.
Yep.
45%, this is the overwhelming majority, say the prequels, Rogue One, and then the original trilogy followed by the sequel trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And only 19% would go with the machete order. Now, that could be that they don't know what that is, which is the dropping of the Phantom Menace, episode one, episode 2, the original trilogy, and then episode 3. So you're preserving that Darth Vader reveal. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a cool order. It's something that we'll never be able to experience.
I think it... remind me, how does it go again? So you cut Phantom Menace.
It's for newbies. So you cut the Phantom Menace because most of that is considered to be unneeded. So you kick off with episode 2. Then you follow that up with... Hang on. How does it work? Episode 2. You drop Phantom Menace. Episode 2. And then you go, I think, New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, then Episode 3, and then Return of the Jedi. Is that right?
That sounds about
I think you're preserving the Luke, I'm your father reveal.
And the Leia one as well.
Yes, the Leia's the sister one. Yeah, so it's something like that. It's very odd. It would probably be quite easy with all the computers that are hanging around this room for me to look into it, but I'm not going to because I will fall down a rabbit hole. But yeah, so only 19% of people. Now, Machete Order, I think, is for introducing new fans. So right. If you had some young Star Wars fans growing up in your household, that might be something that's present on your mind. What's the best way to expose these people to it for the first time?
Yeah.
But in terms of our tweet, it's preferred viewing order. And so I think I'm probably going to hybrid some of this. I'm not going to go with the majority because I would always want to watch the original trilogy first.
Yeah.
To me, now it comes down to where would I put Rogue One?
Mm.
So it might actually be interesting to do Rogue One, A New Hope through Jedi, then prequels, then sequels. Maybe that would be the way if I was going to do a marathon.
I'd be interested to double check to kind of rewatch Rogue One and think how much of this can you get without the prequels. I think you can get it all.
Yes.
I think it makes sense in isolation.
Yeah, it does. I think that if you were someone that's coming to this fresh and you watch Rogue One first, by the time you get to the prequel trilogy, Coruscant is going to be, you might think, oh, well, I've already been there in that brief moment in the... So, it's an interesting experiment to see how Tarkin comes across if you watch him first CGI and then you see Peter Cushing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a shame that you can't just sort of Eternal Sunshine this thing out of your mind so that you can get it all in for the first time again. That would be really nice.
Yeah, that would be cool. Yeah.
Well, thanks for everyone that took the time to vote. So just to be completely clear, when we come out of this, 45% of people would be prequels, Rogue One, then the OT, followed by the sequel trilogy. That seems to be the overwhelming preferred option. There are some other colourful ones in there where people add the Clone Wars in.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I think, seems to be the most sensible way to view Star Wars.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be the one I'd go for because I like the Leia reveal, and you lose that from episode 1 to 3 as well. It's not just the Vader one, you know.
Because of the naming of the twins. To me, the Luke, I am your father is a really important moment in Star Wars, and so I think I might be tempted to try and preserve that above all else.
Mm-hmm.
The Leia reveal, of course, is very interesting.
Yep.
But apart from those two parts, I think you can kind of, if you juggle the films around to preserve those two parts, you're good to go, in my estimation, I think.
Sure.
Interesting topic. I don't know, I might generate one for next week. We'll see. All right, this week I thought we'd add a new section to the pod. There's nothing to cover in the thank you section this week. Let's just get that out of the way. There's not been a lot of movement. It's been a very quiet week. I'm sure as we get closer to Solo, that will change.
Maybe.
But in this week's show notes, I thought we'd drop a new section in. So get your thoughts on the hottest topics. It did have a silly title, but I've dialed that back to something that's pretty straightforward. So your thoughts on hottest topics. Now, this week, there's been a lot of talk about the recasting of Leia. And that's probably going to be the title of this episode as well. Should we recast Leia?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see Carrie on the cover art as well. This has been something that has been spoken about in certain areas this week. I know a lot of the reputable, I know like the guys at Tumbling Sober didn't want to touch the topic really out of respect. And I know the guys over at Making Star Wars, they felt that it was a bit clickbaity. And I'm inclined to agree with them. It's not necessarily the subject I'm interested in discussing isn't about should we sign a petition to get Meryl Streep to play Leia. It's more about revisiting the concept of, is there room to recast this character?
Yeah.
I'll bury the lead. I don't think there is. But I wanted to reach out to the people within our community and get their take on it so that we can at least table it for discussion. So we've got two entries to sort of get to. But before we do, I thought it might be interesting, Rob, just to get your take on it. I've already thrown mine out there. I don't think recasting Carrie or recasting the character of Leia is an option. I don't think you can ever get around that. Having said that, Rob, what's your take on it?
No, I totally agree. I think it's I don't see it as a thing I would be particularly on board with at all. For me, you know, every person who's involved with Star Wars has always said, you know, Carrie is Leia and Leia is Carrie.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can simultaneously hold the position that that's true while also being willing to accept somebody else playing that role.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, if it's a prequel, that's different because it's before we are introduced to that character in the form we're used to. So, you know, the Solo thing, it's not a problem for me because it's not a part that Harrison Ford could have ever played.
Yeah.
Whereas, but for the unfortunate passing of Carrie Fisher, this one is undoubtedly would have been her, and it wouldn't have even been would they have ever countenance discussion about that if she hadn't passed away? No, of course not. Thus, I don't understand. You know, for me, I'd be grudgingly accepting of them just telling her story outside the screen.
Yeah.
Tell it in a book or tell it in a comic. I realize it's not ideal for the people who don't read it, but I think the people who are sufficiently interested will find it.
Yeah.
Because it's not like just because people don't read the books regularly, they don't know they're there. Because they're plugged all over Amazon and Audible and other services are available and all that.
Yeah. And if you're, I think we sort of touched on something similar to this last week. If you're the sort of person that only goes to the cinema once in a while and you might see every Star Wars film, but then that's it, you're not going to pick up the Blu-ray, you're not going to watch YouTube, then the way Carrie leaves, or the way Leia leaves the story, see, to me, these characters, Carrie and Leia are interchangeable, so
I
do that often. If you're that person, you go to the movie, you don't bother picking up the DVD, you're probably not going to care. You'll read it in the opening crawl. It's been a couple of years since Leia died, whatever. Probably be better written than that. And you will... that will be the end of your investment in that part of the story. You're not going to look for books. You're not going to look for expanded storytelling.
Yeah.
But for us, you can do that. You can put it in the opening crawl. You know, it's been 5 years. The death of Leia Organa looms large over the galaxy. That kind of thing will be enough for us. And we can think, right, thank you. I'll plug every hole in my knowledge with the expanded storytelling, with the comic books that are inevitable, with the books, the novelizations that are inevitable, with the audiobooks, all of that good stuff. They can really do it justice, and they can tell endless stories then. And Carrie's not a consideration because the Leia is existing on in another form without Carrie's participation. She's done the heavy lifting. She's done the hard work at that point.
Yeah.
For Leia to be able to exist without her in a story. And then put the character neatly to rest in the movie, in the opening moments of the movie. And just as Luke's presence was felt throughout The Force Awakens, even though he wasn't on screen, she will have the same effect.
Yeah.
She'll be present in the film without being conspicuous by her absence. Yeah. You know, she'll be a part of the plot or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's going to require a gentle touch, but I think they can do it.
I can't see it, you know, being done with a recast. I think in fact, I seem to recall, I don't know where I read this, but I seem to recall reading somewhere that petition was a bit of a, it was been whipped up out of nothing.
Yeah.
There was a bit of idle kind of clickbait to it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is a thing. I think it is. That is kind of the internet today.
Yeah.
Is that people will try and make, there's some notoriety to be had from these sorts of stunts, and that's kind of the thing, I think. It's an interesting topic, and that's why, obviously, I've asked people to sort of invest some time in it this evening.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting topic, but not something that I've invested anything more in than this.
Yeah.
You know, let's get your opinions on whether or not it's even doable. Because we know that Lucasfilm don't share that opinion, or they'd be considering the CGI.
Yeah.
Getting a voice artist in, like the lady that did Leia's voice on Star Wars Rebels.
Yep.
Getting a body double in and putting ILM to work. They could do it. And her estate gave their approval, but they've decided not to. So that's a good sign. But Rob, I'm going to throw this over to you because I've been talking a lot. Would you like to take Brad's input on the subject of whether or not Leia should be recast? He's given us a written perspective.
Yeah, by all means. So Brad writes, "Hey guys, Brad Tracy here. In regard to recasting Leia Organa, I think it's a terrible idea. Whoever that poor actress is, she will automatically be set up for failure. Even if it's Meryl Streep, who would undoubtedly give an award-winning performance, she'll never be accepted by a highly critical Star Wars fandom. I like the idea of someone like Claudia Gray writing another novel about Leia and have her die as a true hero somewhere between episodes 8 and 9, then simply mention her in the opening crawl. It'll still get a collective tear from the fans when they read it. That's my two cents worth. Thanks for listening and keep up the great work. May the Force be with you, Brad.
Excellent position.
I hadn't thought from the point of view of the expectations on the person who plays Leia, but that's a really good point.
Yeah. You just have to look at how prickly fandom is.
Totally, yeah.
The least little thing, you know, and it's, and I think it would be a poison chalice.
Yeah, indeed.
For that person. But I like Brad's position there a lot, where he says if you could give the story to somebody like Claudia Gray and she could tell, or you could get a number of writers together, you could tell a trilogy of stories that fill in the final days of Leia Organa. And you know, the voice we hear and the face we imagine will be Carrie's.
And
Claudia's,
that's how it should be.
Claudia's already proved that she can do that, and
totally,
she can write late life Leia as well as young Leia. So I think that's the right move, and it can all take place off screen.
Yes.
I like that idea, Brad. Thank you so much. And if you haven't, if you're not familiar with Brad, and of course you're part of the Talk Star Wars community, you will be. Brad's got his own podcast, Dex's Diner.
Yes.
So check that out on iTunes as well. I think you'll get a lot out of that. All right, this is Casey. Now this is Casey's Corner, bumped to the top of the show this week.
This is important.
So somebody else has captured the corner this week. But Casey sent us in a voicemail on this very topic of whether or not a recast of Leia would be a good idea. So this is what Casey had to say.
Hey guys, it's Casey here. I saw the post in the Talk Star Wars VIP Facebook group asking for people's opinions on what to do about Carrie Fisher in the upcoming trilogy movie. So I thought I'd send in a voicemail, give my opinions on that for the week. This is one of those things that there is no good answer, is there? Disney's really kind of been put in a terrible position on this. As I'm sure you've probably already discussed at this point. I think because of that, to me, the way to look at this is more just, it's not what's the good option. There is no good option. The good option would have been Carrie Fisher. You've got to look at, like, what's the least bad option, I guess, is kind of the way I'm looking at this. Because nothing's ever going to satisfy the fans, and that's something I think I'm sure Disney understands, is that no matter what they do, there's going to be so much complaining. So many fans are going to hate it. No matter what they do, there's just no way to keep people happy on this. So the best way to do it is just look at what's the least bad option, I guess. And to me, I see that I think they've got three main options, which are CGI Carrie, recast Leia, or do an off-screen death. And first of all, I honestly didn't hate CGI Tarkin as much as everybody else seemed to, so I don't think CGI Carrie would be the worst option, but everybody else seemed to hate CGI Tarkin, so I'm guessing that's, no one's going to agree with me on that, so I think they should probably take that option off the board. So that would leave either off-screen death or recast. I noticed in the post you guys mentioned that Meryl Streep's name had been thrown around, which admittedly doesn't sound horrible. I didn't think, when I tried to think about it, you know, trying to think of anybody who could replace her, everyone sounds horrible because it's just not Carrie. But honestly, I think Meryl Streep wouldn't be a bad option if they're going to go that way. And as far as an off-screen death, again, none of them are good options. It would certainly feel cheap, you know, to just kind of, oh, hey, well, you weren't looking, she died. You know, that's, no one's going to be happy with that, but again, you're just trying to make do in this situation. And to me, I think by a very slight margin, I would prefer the off-screen death, only because either one is going to take me out of the movie. But an off-screen death, you could do it, you could have a moment about it, and it's one moment, you're taken out of the movie for that moment where you think, well, that's cheap, and, you know, I know they just had to do that because of Carrie Fisher dying in real life, but recasting, I think seeing someone else's Leia every time they're on screen, it would take me out of the movie. So by a very, I'm not happy with either one, but by a very slim margin, I would have to say I think I'd honestly rather see an off-screen death than someone else's Carrie, because it just would be too jarring every time to see someone else. Sorry, someone else's Leia. Trying to see someone else play Leia, just it would feel wrong every time they're on screen. Whereas at least the off-screen death is a single thing, awkward moment. Let's get past it and try and go on with the movie. So that's my pick. Not happy with any of them, but if I have to pick one, I'm gonna begrudgingly say off-screen death. So can't wait to hear what you guys think.
Nice, excellent. Thanks, Casey.
Yeah, thank you.
Something just occurred to me whilst Casey was talking there about how, you know, an off-screen death, he's saying it's by a narrow margin his preferred option, although he's not really happy with any of them. The thing I think we need to acknowledge here, and it would be wise, I think, to acknowledge, is that as diehard fans, we're the people that will care about that off-screen. We've already mentioned the casuals that only see the film in the theatre, they don't bother Blu-ray, they're not interested in anything else, they're not really going to care. They're going to read that, they're going to accept it, oh, well, that's because of Carrie's death or whatever, and they're going to move on. The people that are invested in it will not come as a surprise to us. We're going to know. The casuals won't know because they won't be reading the news articles, they won't be looking at the Vox Pops. We will know. So we're going to go in prepared that Carrie's absence, Leia's death potentially will be addressed in the opening crawl. It's not going to blindside us. It won't blindside anybody. Even if they're going to go dark, that news is going to get to them first.
Yeah. I don't know. I think you're right to an extent. I do think that her death was enough, penetrated enough of mainstream culture for people to be aware of it.
Yes.
I do think that. Here's an interesting thought that's just kind of popped into my head. It may be, you know, one of those ones where it's like, no, that wouldn't work in practice, but is there ever been a film that's been released to cinemas where in order to commemorate somebody who was either in the film or was supposed to be in the film, they've opened with a little montage or any sort of dedication?
I don't know. I don't think so. Don't think so. I think that you usually get those in the end credits, like we got with The Last Jedi. I usually get that sort of acknowledgement. I don't recall something starting that way.
No, because I feel like that would be a way of handling it. And you could even, you know, I mean, I know for a fact they have enough pre-roll footage and behind the scenes and interviews about her that they could do a little pre-film documentary, almost like a little short montage thing, a couple of minutes of people just talking about how important she was, even just George talking about how important she was at Celebration.
Yeah,
they could do something with that.
Yeah,
I think
you remember that that little video they put together. It was cut to Bowie, Rebel.
Yeah.
Oh, so good. When that came on at Celebration, I was like, well, you know what I'm like. I was just like this quivering mess, just this wreck. Something like that would be great. I remember when, what was it? Was it Firefly that came out? It was the movie version of Serenity. Yeah, Firefly. That came out, at least for the initial releases, with a talking headpiece from Joss Whedon, who thanked everybody for being brown coats, thanked everybody for the support and all that sort of stuff, and helped them get there to the big screen. Something like that, I think, would be really fitting for like the midnight 01 release of episode 9, where you would have the cast and crew sort of just give their thoughts, perhaps, on Carrie, address it there at the beginning, because they've done their post-credits tribute to Carrie Fisher. It's not really necessary in episode 9, but episode 9 is going to be the first film where her absence is really felt. So it would seem fitting to me that, you know, a pre-show reel of some kind that acknowledges her and her contribution to Star Wars and her importance to fandom.
Yeah.
I think that would be suitable.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I don't know, he's absolutely right that there's no good answer to this.
No, there's not a good option, is it?
It's purely about what's the least crappy option to deal with, you know, and that's the trick of it, basically, is, you know, there's no good option.
No.
Ultimately, so it's purely, you're not going to be able to please everybody. All they can do is what's, you know, what's simplest and what's least objectionable, and go from there and hope for the best that fandom understands. And I think most fans will. You know, I think realistically there are going to be people who complain, but they'll complain. There'll be a percentage of fans that complain no matter what you do.
Oh yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh yeah,
there will be people that's what they live for, and yeah, and that's okay. That's fine if that's how you get your yah-yahs, then more power to you. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's going to be there's going to be a divide. There are going to be the people that go in who are so invested that they're going to be affected by it. They're going to go in forewarned, and therefore forearmed. Mm-hmm. The other people, the casuals, they're going to be aware of Carrie's passing, most likely, but it's not going to affect their position on the film in any way, shape, or form. They're not going to expect to see her on screen. They're not going to. They're probably not debating. Probably not giving any thought to how it's going to be managed. And when they read it in the opening crawl, there might be a second where they go, "Oh yeah, of course, that's how they handle this."
Yeah,
and then they're in the movie and they won't give it a second thought. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there's kind of that division, which is a very interesting division that we've kind of looked at before, that the audience that goes in cold to Star Wars doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily true with the lack of Carrie Fisher. I think that's going to be on everyone's minds, but to degrees of investment. We're going to be heavily invested in it, but we are not going to be blindsided by anything. We're going to know.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be... one of the first thing that's going to be on the front of every podcaster and blogger's questions list for JJ, isn't it?
Totally.
How did you get around it? What did you do?
So, I don't know. Leave me alone.
Yeah, well, God, I wish I hadn't signed up for this. I should have done Regarding Henry too. All right, let's get into some listener comments. Thank you, Brad, and thank you, Casey, for your input on the hottest topics. And stay tuned for what takes center stage next week. I'll be throwing that out in the Facebook group for some more input. Yeah. All right, listener comms this week. We've got an email from Jerome. Jerome says, "Hey guys, just a quick question here. My friend and I were arguing about my fear of skeletons and how I don't like watching movies with skeletons in them. Walking skeletons or dead skeletons. He argued that I like Star Wars, which has plenty of skeletons. However, I don't believe there are any skeletons in any of the Star Wars films. Could you settle our argument? Thank you, Jerome." Breakdown, are there skeletons in Star Wars?
Yep.
Lots.
Yeah, quite a few.
Lots and lots. Yeah. So should we break it down by movie? I was thinking about the prequels. Is there anything in the prequels?
I don't know, you know. I don't know. There's not really... Nothing springs to mind. I'm just... I've done a shameful thing and Googled it.
Oh, really? You can do the annoying thing and say, well, those battle droids in Episode 1, kind of skeletal. No, General Grievous.
No, we're talking about proper skeletons.
The OT gives us plenty to work with. It gives us I'm sure there are people out there now screaming their answers. What's the big one in A New Hope?
It's a big one, literally. There's the Krayt Dragon.
There's
also Owen and Beru.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good one. Yes, that's a really good one. Yeah, a little bit charred around the edges.
Yeah, somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fair to say.
Yeah, the big one in the movie is the Krayt Dragon in the wastelands of Tatooine. But yeah, there's a gruesome duo there on the homestead.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty awesome. And in ESB, I think there's Tauntaun in the Wampa Lair. I think you at least see a rib cage.
Yeah,
in the Wampa Lair.
Yeah,
Not sure if there's anything on Dagobah, but that looks like that might be littered with skeletons.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
But then we have lots and lots of skeletal pieces in Return of the Jedi in the Rancor Pit. Right, we have. Mountains, especially there's a nice juicy skull in there that Luke launches lock of the door. But what else you got? What else have you found?
I can't find anything else, you know. You may be right about the prequels, in as far as the prequels.
Yeah, nothing there, no?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's nothing springs to mind in the sequels for certain, and nothing springs to mind in the prequels. I mean, there's probably quite a few on Jeddah in Rogue One. You never see them, but after the Death Star fires, I would say there's probably a few bits of that left.
Yeah. No, but these three examples from the original trilogy, they are huge. And yeah, so I think, actually, Jerome, I think your friend is right. You do like Star Wars, and there are plenty in there, even yes. just those examples that we've listed. And some of it, I mean, that in Episode 4 and Episode 6, there you've got some pretty gruesome examples of skeleton representation.
Yes.
So, yeah. He's right, Jerome, unfortunately.
He's right on both counts. There are skeletons, and you do like Star Wars.
Yes. So there you go.
Ultimately, the fact that you've discussed it in those terms basically suggests that, you know, you've done it the right way, which is talking. Conversation's good.
Yeah, talk Star Wars.
Exactly.
Name's in the title, buddy. All right. Thank you, Jerome. I hope we hear from you again. All right. This is the one I've been looking forward to all week. This is a couple of voice messages. We've got actually three clips to play. The first one is from Bradley Wall, okay. who is a long-time listener, supporter of the Star Wars Commonwealth, Knight of the Commonwealth, actually first-class guy. He sends us in a clip to play, which sets up everything else beautifully. So check out what Bradley has to say.
Hello, Talk Star Wars. Bradley here with a Star Wars question for you guys this week. Actually, they are questions that my daughter has asked. As y'all know, I send in questions weekly to Tumbling Saber, to that podcast, and I thought it'd be kind of cool to send you the same questions that I sent them this week. I would also send to you guys. I would love to hear what y'all have to say. I'd like to get y'all's thoughts and feelings on her questions, and hopefully you'll be able to do that. You'll have fun with it. Looking forward to hearing what y'all have to say.
Thanks, Bradley. Thank you. Right. I should probably put out a warning. You are going to fall in love with Avery. And I'm not just saying that to you, Rob. I'm saying that to everybody. Now, we're okay. fortunate that in our little community, we've got a number of what we like to call TSW juniors. So there's a number of kids that surround our listenership.
Yeah.
Lots of our contemporaries have young families, and mm-hmm. so there's a lot of people we've interacted with, especially on the Facebook live sessions and what have you, and sometimes in the live meetups we've interacted with the next generation of Star Wars fans. Avery is just another one to add to that list of amazing right. amazing child Star Wars fans, the next gen. So we've got two questions from Avery coming up now, and I think they're so insightful, it's incredible. Here's the first one.
Well, I noticed whenever I was watching The Last Jedi for the third time but I noticed that whenever Rose's older sister, whenever they're bringing in the bombers to take out the dreadnought, I noticed that the flap opening on the bottom for the bombs to go out, it's open space, so the people inside of the bombers would have been sucked out, which I'm kind of like, what? Why weren't they sucked out? Because it was open space. And I'm just a little confused about that.
Right. Insightful question, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Fantastic question.
Very much so.
Rob, answer it.
Oh, man. Right, so my understanding of this, so I'm not going to pretend that I'm 100% sure on this particular question. My understanding is that there exists shielding technology within the Star Wars universe that can basically can cover that open yes. space.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it can be done. There's bits in the film where it's not done, I don't think, and that doesn't make sense to me personally, but we've been through that. And the other one to think about as well is the Death Star. Obviously, the Millennium Falcon's able to get through the shield because yeah. there's a shield around the whole thing. But there's bits of the shield. There's two possibilities, basically, Avery. Either there's a bit that the shield doesn't cover, which is possible, especially if it's something that they know there's going to be. But then that doesn't make sense, does it?
No, you're absolutely right. I think you've got it locked in there perfectly. There's a couple right. of, there are a couple of options. And we, Avery, the thing with Star Wars is, we're given, when you watch these movies, and you're going to find it, the more and more you rewatch these things, you start to spot a tool set in place that George put in place, a bunch of rules that we learn, and then we apply to a fresh viewing of something like The Last Jedi. Now, Rob, you're perfectly right with the Death Star is a great example. I've put a line in the show notes as well, the line I lifted from A New Hope, which says, you can hear a guy over the loudspeaker system in the Death Star so say, close all outboard shields.
Mm-hmm.
So what that suggests to me is when they're pulling the Falcon in via tractor beam, well, this is one of our options, right, for how you deal with that, a big open space, open space and an opening in a craft. What this line suggests to me is that when they're pulling the Millennium Falcon in to the Death Star, they're popping yeah. open one magnetic shield, the Falcon goes in, then they're closing it, and then they're opening another one like an airlock. Mm-hmm. So the ship passes through, lands in the landing bay, and then all the shields are re-engaged, and then you're done. There's another option for that, the explanation there, which is mm-hmm. that you alter the... this is very Star Trek-y. You alter the shield's harmonic resonance so it matches the item coming through it. Now, that explains something like blaster fire. If you've got shields up and you're firing blasters out of it, it's because they're synced up, so they're on the same frequency. So you're mm-hmm. firing through the shields. It's a bit like how on an old biplane, the machine gun used to shoot through the props without shooting the props to pieces over timed. So that's kind of a cool thing. Now, a combination of those bits of tech, I think, exist with this bomber situation from The Last Jedi, which is that when Paige opens those Bombay doors, she does, in fact, open the Bombay doors, but there's a magnetic shield in place so that she isn't actually exposed to the vacuum of space and gets, so she doesn't get sucked out and everyone doesn't get sucked out.
Yeah.
But the bombs that they drop, remember they're in space, there's no gravity. The bombs that they drop are actually being propelled by magnetic technology.
Yeah.
So they release the bombs and then they're being pulled to the mass below them,
mm-hmm.
the dreadnought, by magnetism. And that magnetic field around each bomb and the magnetic shield are frequencies that complement each other, say, and pass straight through. Give the appearance that there's nothing there, but you've got the magnetic shield in place. So you're using the same sort of tech that's been hinted at. We've learnt the rules from A New Hope. You can get a ship into the Death Star. The Death Star's just got this great big opening in there. How do they do it? Shields. We've got shield tech in the bomber, but magnetic shields. I mean, we also hear from the X-Wings, don't we, that are passing through magnetic shields of the Death Star. So we know that kind of technology is already in play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think it is. I think the bombs are all at the same frequency as the shields. They can pass through them, giving the impression that there's nothing there. But in fact, there is stuff there that's preventing the crew from being sucked out and going zero G.
Mm-hmm.
But what an insightful question from
it's a great question. Yeah,
it's nice to think, you know, that somebody's looking, she's really watching this film and analyzing it and think that doesn't make any sense. And it's nice to reach out to us, but the answers are there, aren't they, packaged into Star Wars that you learn from the toolkit that's already there.
Indeed.
All right, we've got another question from Avery again about Star Wars. Here we go.
So Avery has another question.
Well, in The Last Jedi, there is a supposedly new technology where they can track the Raddus through hyperspace. And they make it seem like it's all new and stuff, when really it's already been discovered. And it's actually been discovered quite a long time ago, because in the last scene of Rogue One, you see the Tantive IV going away in hyperspace, and in The New Hope, the Empire's Darth Vader's cruiser has already has the Tantive IV like basically tied on a string, quote unquote, from The Last Jedi. Because how would they have found them if they hadn't already tracked them from hyperspace, which I was kind of confused on. And I noticed this like my fifth time watching the Rogue One or something like that. So yeah, that's my question: is have they already discovered the hyperspace tracking, or have they just forgotten about it? Whenever the Empire died, did that kind of knowledge die with them?
That's great. Another great question.
Yeah, that's a good one. I have a better answer for this one.
Go for it.
So the thing about Rogue One versus A New Hope that I have a feeling plays into this quite heavily is that we don't know how much time passes between the end of Rogue One and the beginning of A New Hope. We know it picks up in terms of them being chased, but we don't know how long that chase has taken to kind of manifest. So there's every possibility that, much like in the OT, where they do calculations and try and work out where the rebels are going to end up, they have done the same and, you know, managed to, just been lucky, but, you know, potentially even.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point. We don't know. It does imply that it's kind of like one jump, but we really don't know, do we? Because it's kind of left a little bit out of the way. I don't think it's covered in the novelization.
Not by recall.
I'd have to check, but it's, very good point. So again, there's a couple of things to pull from Star Wars lore, I think, that can help explain this question for Avery, which are a couple of lines from the OT. The first is from The Empire Strikes Back, when Vader gives one of the Imperial commanders an order to... the Falcon jumps to hyperspace when they're not expecting it to, and he says, calculate every possible destination along the last known trajectory. So he's kind of having them crunch the numbers of every possible hyperspace lane that could be used and where that's going to lead, and then just literally send somebody to every one of those destinations and let me know where they are. So that's kind of one option for finding the Tantive in episode 4 from Rogue One to episode 4 is calculating destinations based on the attitude of that ship at the time it jumped into hyperspace. And that's certainly not the technology that we're led to believe is in place during The Last Jedi, that they know where they're traveling whilst in hyperspace.
Yeah, so they know exactly which lane they're in.
Yeah, it's not that they disappear and then reappear and it's left open to, you know, the number crunchers at the Empire working out where they've gone. They actually know where they are throughout their journey in hyperspace.
Yeah.
And there's another piece of technology as well that we've heard referenced in A New Hope, which is Tarkin talking to Vader, where he says, you're sure the homing beacon is secure aboard this ship. So we know the Empire employ other tech, which is planting beacons on craft so they can disappear into hyperspace. As soon as they reappear, those beacons will start to report their location to whatever Imperial outpost is closest, and then that will call the attention of the bigwig. So Vader will know where anybody is because a little beacon's popped up somewhere on the other side of the galaxy. That, again, is technology that's in place during the OT time. So you don't know when that ship's in hyperspace. You've no idea where it is. But once it pops out of hyperspace, it starts sending a signal back to you. It gives the impression that the Empire had ships tied on strings like General Hux does, but I don't think that is. I think it's a combination of crunching the numbers and working out what the most likely destination is, and also having beacons on board the ship so that they start to report back their location, a bit like Find My iPhone, whenever they come out of hyperspace.
Yeah, in the same way as well, actually. Absolutely. And the other thing about the homing beacon example in The New Hope is, again, we don't know how much time passes between when the Millennium Falcon jumps to light speed and the Empire figures out where they are, because there's a big gap where presumably the Rebels are... I mean, I don't imagine the Rebels are... We've only got 20 minutes and they're on their way.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like it's much more likely that they've got a couple of days at a push in terms of how long they have to train themselves and steel themselves before the Empire arrive.
Yeah, before they track them down. Because the events of Empire Strikes Back take place over a really protracted amount of time. Something like a month.
Yeah.
They're on the run. So, you know, the one thing Star Wars has never really done very well is the transition of time. And if you look at The Last Jedi, you can criticize these things all you like, but it's done for dramatic reasons. But that bombing assault on the Dreadnought is painfully slow compared to what... you think it is slow, but surely that gives the ships plenty of time to defend.
Yeah.
It's slowed down so that we can take all this stuff in. And so the passage of time in a Star Wars movie is not really handled very well, and it's done so deliberately for creative reasons.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. They jump, and it could take them ages to track them down, and we're seeing it instantaneously because otherwise it would be really boring viewing.
Films move at the speed of plot.
They move at the speed of plot, say. Yeah. Fantastic quote. Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's it, Avery. I think that's it. I think you're seeing a bunch of tech that looks like it's doing the same thing, but you've got number crunchers calculating destinations, and you've got beacons broadcasting destinations after arrival. But the technology in The Last Jedi, and what makes it new, is that they can track the ships whilst they're actually in hyperspace, and that's the new aspect of the technology. Yeah. That once the ship is in a hyperspace lane, the First Order can track it. They know where it is at any given moment.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
I'm trying to think of a good car-related analogy. It's like knowing which road somebody's taking versus being behind them on the motorway.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, having visibility of the car versus knowing where they are likely going and which road they're going to be on. Thus, you can sort of get there ahead if you know a better way or something. It's hard to explain. I know what I mean.
Yes. It's incredibly insightful, Avery. I think. And I really love the fact that you're questioning this stuff, because it's so easy, I think, for audiences just to say, oh, well, that's a thing. When are we going to go for lunch? But no, I like the fact that you're actually watching it, taking it in, questioning it, trying to poke holes in it. It's great. Keep that up, because you'll get so much more enjoyment out of these things when you when you take that approach to it. It's wonderful.
For sure, for sure.
And we hope to hear from you again, Avery. Thank you for the questions. And thank you, Bradley.
Yes, thank you. Indeed.
Brilliant stuff. I enjoyed that. I've been looking forward to that all week. All right, Rob, look who's emailed us.
So this is from... Do you want me to read this one then?
Yeah, take it, mate. Yeah.
All right. From Bunglebush Bunglebush. Hey, hi guys, I'm in a disagreement with a friend about what Yoda means when he says that library contains nothing that the girl doesn't already possess. Okay, first of all, a library without books isn't a library with books. I don't think Yoda knew the books were taken. In other words, actually, that library possesses nothing because the library didn't have any books in it at the time, so how could it possess anything? Also, if Yoda knew the books were gone, why would he make such a big deal about burning the tree down if he knew it was empty of books? See what I mean? Oh well, maybe I'm crazy, but I think I'm right. Love the show, and long live the Star Wars Commonwealth, and long live the Supreme Leader. Nice. Bunglebush, Bunglebush, LOL. So clearly enjoying the fact that you get a kick out of that name.
Yeah, and there was an extra piece at the top of this email, which is your wish is my command, because I'd obviously said please email again.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's good to have regular communications from Bunglebush. Thank you so much. At Bunglebush Squared. So what do you think is at the heart of Yoda's comment there about the books, like the library contains nothing the girl doesn't already possess? Because it can be read a couple of ways, right?
It can, and this is one of those things that's bothered me about the film. It's only a little thing, but I liked the notion that when he said the girl doesn't have anything that she does, you know, the tree doesn't contain anything. That library contains nothing that the girl doesn't already possess. There we go. Thankfully, he's put it in the quotes. That library doesn't contain anything the girl doesn't already possess. I thought that was a metaphor. And I liked the fact that it was a metaphor, because it was basically saying you're putting too much stock in these books. You know, you've not even read. They sort of established that he hasn't even read them in any great depth.
Yeah.
I really liked that, because it was kind of illustrating a point that Luke was a little bit hung up on the dogma rather than the Force.
Yeah.
And then we find out that she took the books. And when he says that library contains nothing she doesn't already possess, he's being very literal. And I found that very disappointing.
Yeah.
Similarly, it bothers me, you know, the idea that that's anything other than metaphor, but bothers me significantly because it's, like I say, it's not that clever anymore. You know what I mean? It's like there was something really smart about it when they sort of alluded to the fact that Luke was almost, you know, in the wrong.
And that's my read on it, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, not yeah. I think that is my
either
read.
Either way, yeah. Either way, that's the case, isn't it? I mean, that's for sure.
It is. I think you got to look at it. Well, all right, you don't have to. This is subjective, I guess. But this is, to me, you get more mileage out of this moment. The moment is between Luke and Yoda. Yeah. It's not really about Rey.
No.
It's about Luke and it's about Yoda. And it's the first time those two characters have connected for a significant period, because Luke's been disconnected. He's put the Force on hold. So Yoda, this is the first time Yoda and Luke have interacted, and it's more about Luke's inability to get around that dogma, like you said. Perfect term. Luke's concerned, I need to destroy this thing and burn it to the ground, because he's put so much importance in it. It's so much importance that he dresses in the ceremonial robes every time he goes to do it. And then he stops himself. So Yoda's kind of saying, look, forget the books. There's nothing in there the girl doesn't have. Burn them. And then he burns them with the lightning. Now, if you mix in there, which we don't see on screen, that Yoda knows that Rey took the books, if you say he's in possession of that knowledge that she took the books, the line becomes more literal from a certain point of view, but that doesn't alter the context of the scene, which is, it's still about Luke and Yoda. It's still about Yoda telling his student, get over yourself, get over this dogma, burn it. There's nothing there that a girl needs.
Yeah.
You know, Luke's already learned that the mistakes that were made by the Jedi are a thing, and perhaps those mistakes are what that's central to the writings in that library.
Yeah.
All those mistakes. Mm. So to me, the context of the scene is between Yoda and Luke, and it's Yoda telling Luke to basically burn it down.
Yeah.
Get past it. There's nothing there for the next generation of Jedi. Mm-hmm. You've got to get past that. Yeah. And that's why he burns it. Mm-hmm. He might know that Rey's taking the books. He might think that the books are in there.
I think if he's able to summon lightning down from space and destroy a tree with the power of his spirit rather than his mind, I think it's safe to say he knows the books are gone.
Yeah.
I think it's, yeah. But I will say the tree is still symbolic at that point.
Yes.
Because it still represents one of these. It's actually almost symbolic of the only thing that's something that anchors Luke to Octo.
It
because
is.
It's a tree. It takes root. It's almost Yoda's way of saying, don't let yourself take root somewhere. You know, go where the Force kind of guides you, I guess.
It's also kind of dead as well.
Yeah,
it's
just true.
It's this thing with deep roots that's long since dead, and it's ambitious way of reaching to the sky. There's all this symbolism at play in that. In the choice to use the tree instead of like a cave or something like that, it was deliberate. There's a lot of symbolism at play with roots and death and all that sort of stuff. And the fact that it's probably been there for generations. But that moment, I keep coming back to, that moment is between Yoda and Luke. And therein is the story. It's about that moment between the two of them. There's nothing overt on screen that suggests, like, there's no wink from Yoda to suggest, you know, that girl, she's got those books, you know what I mean? There's none of that. We don't get any insight to whether or not Yoda has that knowledge, because it's not important, because that moment is between Luke and Yoda, and it's about getting Luke past that point in his journey. It's pushing Luke past that point where he can say, I've been talking to the big game about letting this thing die when I really can't. And Yoda's like, let it die. Do it. Yeah. Let it become something else. And, you know, Rey doesn't need those books to build the next generation of Jedi. She's got them. She doesn't need them. That's kind of what he's getting at, isn't it? Luke set her on a path. He's given her the information she needs, which in both in terms of literal education and cautionary tales, she's well set on the path to her journey, whether she's got those books or not, who knows? That might be just the witchcraft. That might just be the how-to guide, you know? This is how you do such... This is how you levitate rocks, or this is how you do whatever, Force Ghost or Phantom or whatever. She doesn't need to dig out the dogma. She might just go in there and take the technique from it. But you know, that this moment that Bungle Bush has written into us about, that's between Luke and Yoda. It's about Luke's journey and Yoda helping him on his journey, and not about Rey.
Yeah.
But it is one of those moments that could be clearer, I guess. But it's to me, that's in my estimation, that's what that means.
Mm-hmm.
I dig it.
Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah, totally.
Thanks, Bungle Bush.
Yeah, thank you.
Can we just call you Bungle Bush?
Bungle Bush 2, like squared.
Yeah.
Or B squared.
Can we get overly familiar and just call you Bungle?
B squared Bush.
All right.
Be there or B squared Bush.
We've got another question this right. week. This time is from Salacious Rum, who got a mention on last week's show in the thank you section. So Salacious Rum says, "Hey, Talk Star Wars peeps, I am Salacious Rum, a drunken half-man, half-Kawakian monkey lizard. My question is this, can we expect to see Jabba the Hutt in the new Solo movie, and how long will he appear and in what context? He still owes me a round of blue milk, an ounce of spice and two packs of death sticks. Don't trust him." No doubt Salacious out. So breakdown. Will Jabba the Hutt appear in Solo, a Star Wars story? And when I first read this email, I thought it just said, "And how long will he be?" Three or four meters.
same sort of length. I mean, it's the width that seems to increase.
How long will he be in the movie? What do you reckon?
I think he's going to be in towards the end, and I don't think he's going to be in for that long.
Okay, right.
That's the sense. I get the sense we're going to end this film being introduced to. Introduced to Jabba, or Han being introduced to Jabba in the sort of final moments of this film. And then if we get more Han Solo movies, maybe they'll deal with the sort of the bits in between.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a cool idea. Yeah. The introduction of it is a nod towards a life we know he leads because we're familiar with him and we have been for decades.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of cool. All indications seem to be that Jabba is actually going to play a part in this. I think I'd kind of prefer that he wasn't, and just give the movie room to move on its own without sort of that being a moment that we're waiting for. But it does make an awful lot of sense. My question would be, do we think Salacious Crumb is going to make an appearance? Who presumably is a cousin of Salacious Rum. Do you think the monkey lizard will be in there? If Jabba is?
I don't know. I got this may be one of those weird things that's apropos of nothing, but I really got the sense that Salacious Crumb was quite young.
Yeah.
That it's quite, you know, it's got high-pitched, squeaky voice, and it's, you know, enthusiastic about being by Jabba's side. I feel like that's a new guy.
There's definitely some legend stuff about this character out there somewhere. I have a feeling that sort of he popped up with someone and got left behind or something.
Oh, okay.
There's something out in the deep recesses of my mind. There's something out there to do with Salacious Crumb.
Is it still canon though, or is it legends?
No. I would think it's almost certainly legends at this point. It will be interesting to see how, if Jabba does appear, how he's represented, because we've only really seen him in one form, haven't we? Be kind of interesting to see him in all business mode. I guess we have seen him in like the Phantom Menace as well, haven't we? In kind of a more regal position.
Yeah.
At the Bunta Reeve race.
Yeah. Yeah, we have. This is true.
I think we should see him. I've done a 180 on this. I think we should see him. End of the movie feels good to me. I think you might be right. The end of the movie. A hint at Han's new life. And it'll be nice if he thinks, right, finally we've arrived and we know what it means. That'll be cool.
Yeah.
Thank you, Salacious. Hopefully we'll hear from you again. I did actually bleep, or I omitted some colourful language in Salacious's email there. Download the show notes and see what it is. It's nothing big. Right, I think that brings us up to our break, mate, which is just about the hour mark. So let's head off for a quick break, and then when we come back, we've got somebody's corner.
Ooh,
I think we've already spoiled who captures the corner. Then we've got a couple of cool bits of Star Wars news, and then we're out. So bear with us, everybody, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. So we've just had our lovely break, and that was fun, and we enjoyed that. So as is customary after our little break, where before we might have put ads in space or something else, and now we don't. So as, this is a weird segue, but I'll take it.
They get slicker and slicker, these segues.
Exactly, exactly. So as is customary after that point, it's time for the corner. And this week, the corner has been captured by Katie. Congratulations.
Katie's corner.
Katie's corner this week. Oh, my congratulations. So Katie writes, hey guys, question for this week is, what is your favorite Lando moment? Mine is him piloting the Falcon in Return of the Jedi. Loved every moment, and that iconic yee-haw from him is just too good. Now we'll most certainly be getting some more great moments from Lando in Solo. Can't wait to see them. Thanks, guys. Thanks. From Katie. So what's your favorite Lando moment, Mark?
I kind of like him in Jedi, but I think he's way more interesting in The Empire Strikes Back. And
I
think to me it's the moment in the corridor with Boba and Vader,
and when he realizes he starts to dawn on him.
He's broken a pretty rough deal, and he's probably not going to get out of that.
This deal's getting worse all the time.
Yeah, he's probably not going to come out of that a winner, is he?
No,
he's kind of made a deal with the devil. So I think that might be my favorite, is that moment of realization. And Billy Dee brings just such a subtlety to that role in that corridor.
Oh, he's great in it.
Yeah, with the
one of the reasons it's so good.
And that James Earl Jones line as well, with the
I am altering the deal.
Pray I don't alter it any further. Yeah. Or menace. So much menace.
Totally.
That's mine, I would think. What's yours, mate?
I think actually it's probably my first introduction to Lando in Empire Strikes Back, because you've had this build up of, you know, Han's talking about Lando and Chewie's bringing up the fact that, you know, there's clearly some sort of history there, and he's saying, that was you know, years ago, I'm sure he's forgotten all about it, and then he comes out, you dirty no good swindler.
Yeah, that's
and he
good.
Just gets proper irate, and then, you know, he just kind of flips it on its head straight away, and you know, it's all warm and fuzzy and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it's quite, you know, that I love that moment, because it's just, it's such a departure from the rest of the tone of the film. It's just a moment of levity, which then lasts, what, 3 or 4 minutes tops before it's back to, oh no.
Yeah, back to sinister. It is really cool, because we're all put in a position of security, aren't we? We're dropped in there. We don't have any more information than they do. And we're dropped into that moment with them. And I think that's really cool. Really, a really good, really interesting sort of tool to use as a storyteller, is to keep your audience ignorant to what's really going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then drop us in it with the heroes.
It's effectively done, you know.
Yeah, really good. And he really sells that moment as well. And, you know, Harrison giving him what he does, because Harrison Ford's quite a generous sort of actor, isn't he? And he's sort of giving Billy Dee the frame. And when you think, this is Harrison Ford kind of at the height of his powers, you know, he's just about to bag, I think he's just about to do Blade Runner, just about to do Indy. This is Harrison Ford at the pinnacle, and he gives that moment to Billy Dee Williams. It's really, really cool, yeah. I also really like that moment just before they step out of the doors onto the landing pad, Lando and Lobot are deep in conversation.
Yeah.
I'd love to know what that exchange is.
That would be good.
We've learned that Lobot has a bit more agency than we'd really given him credit for. In the comic book at least, there was some agency there, wasn't there? There's a relationship that exists between Lando and Lobot. So I wonder if this is like a hangover of that, holdover of those interactions with Lobot perhaps saying, You know what you're doing, you're getting us into trouble.
Yeah.
And he's like trying frantically to just sort of say, stay at least one step ahead of this whole thing that's about to go south on him. But
hey, it'll be okay. Yeah. How about some Colt malt liquor?
Yeah, it works every time. That's good stuff. Yeah, I like that. I'm very much looking forward to Don Glover's take on this character.
Mm.
It's going to be superb. Thank you, Katie. Congratulations on totally owning that corner this week.
Yep.
Look forward to see what you see got
if we should
time.
We can see if we can get a consecutive corner. Consecutive corner holding every week. See how long people can do it for.
Yeah, see if they fight for the corner.
There's no prize. It's just for fun.
Yeah, but we could get a prize together.
Maybe
a car or a house.
Yeah, let's not
overstretch
anything down. Yeah, okay, let's not lock anything down for now, just in case.
Yeah. All right. Then. Yeah. Let's get into some Star Wars.
The week before Christmas, you'd be like, "Did you sort that out in the end?"
Yeah.
What?
Same Katie, that Merc we spoke about. All right, let's talk about some Star Wars news. So Ron Howard is back in the world of social media, which has made me so happy this week. He put out a couple of tweets and some Instagram posts from the post-production suite of Solo: A Star Wars Story. There's a couple of images that have popped into the show notes. One of a space battle involving a TIE fighter and something that's exploded. And also there's something which looks like, I'm going to go with the audio mix there at Skywalker Sound. Would you say that image on the right-hand side? Whole bunch of mixing desks.
I would imagine that is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
I guess it could also be ADR.
It could be.
Going on.
Yeah, it could be. They could have like the little recording booth behind them somewhere. But it's, it's a really impressive setup there. It's not entirely dissimilar to S2DO. So where I am right now looks very close to that.
A little smaller, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, this Skywalker Sound thing. They've got a way to go before they're really established. This looks good. This stuff that Ron's been leaking, trickling out to us, teasing, is really cool. This shot of Han, that says to me the Imperial Hauler scene on Vandor, I think we discussed that last week.
Okay.
That's what I think that moment is. So it's so tantalising. There was also another exchange on Twitter between Ron and a fan. The fan goes by the name of @red2_standingby. And he reached out and asked Ron, his initial tweet was asking Ron where we are with Solo, I believe. And Ron said, the release date May 25th, the edit's locked, the score is done, we're right on schedule, hope you check out Solo and find it fun. And then @red2_standingby says, actually now think about it, will there even be another trailer? Because obviously with the release date looming large. And Ron came back with yes. Yep. A very simple yep tweet response. So we're certainly going to get another trailer. Avengers? Does it feel like an Avengers release trailer?
I guess it could be. That would make sense, wouldn't it? Because they pushed Avengers forward now, haven't they?
They brought it up, yeah.
Yeah, so that would fit. That would be about right.
Yeah. We'll put it about a month away.
There's nothing else. I mean, I think Deadpool 2 is not far enough away from Solo to justify it. I think it's too close, isn't it?
And it's not the same studio, is it?
No, it's not, but at the same time, you know.
Audience is audience, right? But I think Avengers is going to draw a lot more attention.
Oh, for sure.
And being from the same stable, the Disney stable, it makes sense to me that they would try and aim for that and couple the Solo trailer to the Avengers release, but let's be honest, it's going to hit YouTube anyway. It's not a theatre. We're not limited to theatre exposure at this point. Yeah. Although I am aware that there's something streaming into theatres now with a 10th of April ETA. Mm-hmm. So whether that's a Solo trailer or not, I don't know. I'll keep you posted. Well. But it is very interesting because these things, when they start to come in, under the title, under the heading embargoed content, so we don't know, we don't know any specifics. It could very well be the second trailer or the full, I guess it'd be the first theatrical trailer, won't it, for Solo, being that the other one was a teaser. Nice to know we're going to get one, though. But yeah, keep an eye on that that headset for the Avengers Infinity War. I expect there was a little extra solo in there. Another news item that hit this week that I'm really quite jazzed about. We've only got a couple more bits on this week's show notes. There's not a great deal out there. I got a comment from Mark that I didn't put in the show notes. We'll discuss that in a second. But John Boyega was at AwesomeCon last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And he has told us that Finn and Rey are to reunite on screen in Star Wars Episode 9. This is a quote from John. He says, "I haven't read the script for Episode 9, but Daisy did shoot me a text saying, 'Oh my gosh, I've just heard from JJ and we're back together.'" And then John Boyega goes on to say, "That's what I'm really excited about. Finn and Rey back together again." Do you think this is JJ playing to his strengths? Because he had a huge amount of success with that interplay on screen between Finn and Rey. Really worked. And it was something that Ryan hadn't really seen at the time he started putting together The Last Jedi, because it wasn't in the can yet.
No.
And certainly didn't know it would be received by the audience. So do you think this is JJ just sort of saying, well, we're going to give the audience more of what they love? They loved that last time.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, it's entirely, you know, they're going to have to have listened, if they have any sense at all, they're going to have listened to some criticism of Last Jedi. And maybe one of the things that people said was they missed that, you know, they missed that rapport and they didn't really have an equivalent, because the Finn and Rose thing was nowhere near as, there was nowhere near as much warmth in it as in terms of between the two characters. Not to knock the performances, it's not about the performances, it's just they don't have that same dynamic and that same rapport.
Yeah, and the situations they were in, the motivations were very different.
Yeah.
Rey and Finn, they got caught up in the same, it was like escape, wasn't it? It was escape and rescue, escape and rescue. It wasn't really about, let's go on this mission. And Rose is very much suspicious of Finn in The Last Jedi, isn't she? So there's that.
Yeah.
You know, the dynamics at play were very different.
Uh-huh.
And there's something more, there's much more innocence in TFA, I think, for these two characters. They seem very lost in this universe. So I wonder how that is going to change by the time we get to Episode 9. Because part of my, you know, I'm anticipating a time jump. Maybe 4 or 5 years to be in line with the actual time that's passed between The Force Awakens and Episode 9.
Yeah.
So in that sort of time jump, I wonder if that is in fact a thing, what they're going to do to evolve these characters. Will you make Finn more of a military leader and Rey be his sort of Jedi ward or Jedi charge? Maybe a... almost like the Jedi generals in the Clone Wars, or will there be something more innocent at play?
Yeah.
Will it be swept up in events? You know,
the other thing is just because they're together again in the film, it doesn't mean they stay together for the whole movie.
No, it's kind of implied.
It's kind of implied, but I mean, Luke, Han, and Leia are back together in Return of the Jedi, but there are bits where they break off and do their own thing.
Of course, yeah.
You know, like obviously Luke goes back to Dagobah, and finishes his training, as it were.
That, of course, is essential for Rey. I think if we're going to see Mark, if we're going to see Luke Skywalker again, it's going to be in Force Ghost form, presumably.
Sure.
So it's going to be essential for Rey to be able to step away from Finn and step away from what they're doing, so that she can commune with Luke, if that is in fact what the relationship will be going forward. So that structure from Jedi, kind of important to preserve for this movie. So yeah, you do get the fan favorites back together, you do get a big mission or something. I know John Boyega has been saying, I think the next thing is going to be all out warfare. I hope there's not so much of that. I hope there's a bit of that, but I want to see something else too. And yeah, I certainly think that there's room to sort of let Rey go and have a moment at least where she can connect to the only people she can connect to for guidance and information.
How plausible do you think it is that there's a possibility of Rey connecting with Luke in the Force while Finn's in the room and he's kind of there for comedic effect of what are you talking about? Who are you talking to?
Yeah, I think it's very possible. I think almost highly likely. But yeah. I kind of had enough of that mugging from Finn in The Last Jedi. And that sounded terribly negative, and I don't really mean it to come across that negative. But there was a lot of John Boyega double takes with his kind of his face scrunched up, as if to say, really? Is this a thing? You know, look at Canto Bight and look at anything that Finn really does. Like when they blow up the shuttle on the beach, there's a lot of this kind of, really? And yeah. I hope we don't get much more of that. I want to see that character mature a little bit, I guess. I still want the innocence there, but I want him to sort of be a little bit more in command of his position within this story in the next movie, so that, you know, we know he's there because he wants to be there.
Yeah.
He's got purpose and a bit of dignity. I hope there's not too much mugging. I don't want John Boyega just to be a comic relief.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's there's a bit of that to it, and it's a bit annoying.
Yeah.
To be honest.
He and the character of Finn are capable of so much more in these stories, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that hopefully we'll see that in the next movie. I was just thinking of something that popped into my head. Do you still think there's going to be a time jump? Because I feel like there has to be.
There's got to be.
Yeah. There's no way they can make it, you know, the number of people on the Falcon is the entire resistance now. They have to at least have a few months of time jumping, if not more.
Yeah.
Just to establish that they might, you know, they could establish in sort of hindsight that the allies of the resistance heard the call but didn't get there in time. You know, that's something they could, that's a way they could approach the problem.
Yeah.
But right? So that's easy enough.
Yeah.
At the same time, what you can't have is they just pick up immediately where they left off, and it just doesn't work. They need to build up again.
Well, you've already, like, I was going to write a piece about this week, but I just haven't had the time. It seems to me like JJ's Mystery Box has done Star Wars a bit of a disservice, a little bit of a disservice, because we ran up to the closing moments of TFA before we revealed Luke. And then you've got two options, I guess, two options really, with the next movie, with The Last Jedi. You do a time jump and you suggest that Luke greeted Rey warmly and then spent a bunch of time training her.
Yeah.
So that Last Jedi takes that required leap forward in time for everybody to move forward. All the characters can evolve somewhat and the situations can evolve somewhat. So you've got some shorthand to sort of say, well, this character's now leveled up a little bit because, you know, while we've been away, they've learned how to fly. Like Finn's learned how to fly, or he's become a general, or, you know.
Yeah.
But what happened with JJ's Mystery Box is they wanted that to be, the end of Force Awakens needed to be ambiguous, which kind of meant Ryan was beholden to that story element and address it straight on. So those two films are squished up against each other now.
Yeah.
And you can't get away from that. You haven't had a chance to move any of the characters forward, any of the relationships forward, or any of the situations forward. So there's no downtime whatsoever.
Very true.
If they did it with the next movie, I think those characters are going to suffer for it, because no one's been able to evolve, or any of the story, the situation, nothing's moved forward. So these characters, we'd have spent 6 years with them at that point, I guess.
And it'll be for the sake of a few weeks of advancement.
No one's moved anywhere.
Wouldn't work, yeah.
Yeah, like, or we'd have spent 4 years with them, 2015 through 2019. So we're familiar with these characters, but no one's actually evolved at all.
Yeah.
We all have, but that's why I think that a huge time jump, it will mean this trilogy is going to be really weird, where you've kind of got one big movie and then one little movie that comes a couple of years later. I think it's necessary to advance everything, more than just for the addressing the problem with Carrie. You've got characters you sorely need to move forward now. You need to give Rey something more, because you don't want to go into episode 3 of your trilogy with her just trying to learn stuff. It would be much more interesting now to sort of leap forward 4 years and come back to her, and she's kind of a little bit more serious, a little bit more focused, a little bit more capable as a Jedi. trying to feel out a way, trying to reestablish the Jedi Order, whatever. And the same for, you know, Finn, Rose. Give them all, move them all forward, on move all these pieces on the board just ahead a little bit, make them more capable, make them more engaged. It just answers that problem. I think JJ's problem was the mystery box, trying to keep that ending a surprise for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It just, it hobbled The Last Jedi in a way. Whereas if you look at the OT, each of those films takes a nice, neat jump forward in time.
Yeah.
Not dramatic, not as dramatic as the prequel trilogy, like 10 years forward and a couple of years forward.
Mm-hmm.
With the OT, it's like, what, maybe 6 or 8 months, a year, 2 years, whatever, between movies.
Yeah.
It's enough time so that you can just say, these characters are slightly different because they've moved forward in time. And mm-hmm. not, well, these characters are exactly the same as the thing. Where are we going with this?
Yeah.
I find it really odd.
Mm.
I find it really very odd. So, yeah, I do think there's going to be a time jump. I want it. And I think it's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah.
And 4 years seems to feel right because it's in line with the way everybody would have aged in the real world as well. So you mm-hmm. explain how characters look different. Than they did if you're just talking about a few hours between movies.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Is there a limit to how far forward they can go?
I think there's a limit in terms of how far they need to go, in terms, you know, in the sense that I think any further is just going further for the sake of going further.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. My feeling is a couple of years would probably do it.
Yeah.
Plus also you have to think of ages of actors and how credible they look in the ages they're kind of purporting to be.
Yes.
Because we don't really get a clear sense of how old these characters are, but I think past a certain point, somebody ages by 10 years, you can tell.
Yeah, and they're in that time, especially with the younger actors as well, they're in that period of their life where they did TFA, they're in their early 20s.
Yeah.
And now they're in their mid to 20s. That is a huge period of time. A lot of changes take place. And you look at Daisy in the early stuff of The Force Awakens, she looks very young.
Yes.
And now she's looking that little bit more mature, not old, by any stretch of the imagination, but also a lot more athletic.
Mm-hmm.
She's got more of an athletic build now than she had in those early shots in TFA. So it's a funny one.
Yes, indeed.
I think a couple of years narratively seem right to me, but I think that my personal estimation is that maybe 4 years is probably enough because you don't want to push it too much
mm-hmm.
with how you're supposed to accept how old these characters are getting.
Yeah.
The last thing you want is to turn up and Finn's got a grey goatee beard and an eye patch. You know, it's just going to call attention to itself, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, last thing is a bit of a throwaway thing, last bit on the show notes this week, and it's a character reveal. This is from a Topps trading card, but I do believe this was featured in some Denny's promotional material.
Okay.
I think it's a clip, a video clip, in fact.
Right.
Of a bunch of aliens from Solo: A Star Wars Story, and then this name came out on a menu from Denny's, a name for a character. Okay. Which we see here on Tops. He's going to make a cracking Black Series figure. His name is Therm Scissor Punch.
Right.
And he is Therm. He looks like a lobster, right?
Yeah.
So maybe Therm is short for Thermidor.
Yeah.
He's fantastic. He is an absolutely brilliant little character that just calls back to the kind of Forlum / Zookas, whatever your school of thought is on the naming convention, that kind of insectoid bounty hunter from Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
This guy, I'm getting those vibes from him. What do you think of Therm Scissor Punch, Rob?
I think that's an interesting name. It's a little bit silly.
Yes.
But I kind of like it.
This is one of those things where I don't expect the name, you know, I don't think Boba Fett's referred to by name until Jedi, right? I don't expect this character to be addressed in this movie. I don't imagine Han's going to walk in the room and go, oh, Therm Scissor Punch over here. It's Han.
Yeah.
I don't imagine that being a thing. This is for toy packaging, Lego sets and promotional materials.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be on screen. Yeah, it's going to be unsaid, isn't it? because it is ludicrous and also kind of rude sounding as well. I'm not sure why my mind went there.
I do know what you mean.
It's kind of, maybe it's the Brit in me, but it just can't sound slightly smutty.
Yeah, I know. I do understand what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. By the time you're hearing this podcast, there will be a Scissor Punch t-shirt in the Tee Public store.
Amazing.
Treat yourself. I thought it was kind of interesting. I mentioned a comment from Mark that I'll throw out there. Mark did weigh in on the whole casting of Carrie Fisher, recasting of the role of Leia.
Okay.
And he said that she was irreplaceable. The position he took was that he didn't think it could be done.
Yeah.
He knows that the CGI thing had been considered and that had been even temporarily entertained. But he did feel, much like we do, that, recast, not so much a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's even Mark thinks that.
Yeah, I do understand why people would like to do that. Yeah, I do understand the logic for people thinking it's needed because they want to continue the Leia story. But I think it's really hard to... say, there's no good answer, but I think it's really hard to justify how you can separate the two, because I just can't.
No.
If somebody else can, more power to you, but I would struggle to separate the two characters, the character and the person playing the character in any forward moving trajectory. You know, like I say, in a prequel, the rules are rewritten because they have to be by their very nature.
Yes, yeah. I think Millie Bobby Brown, as she plays 11 in Stranger Things, she's kind of indicated that she's interested in the Leia role. A young
she looks the part.
She really looks the part, and she's fantastic. A really talented performer. So I would approve of that. If we go back, they'd have to pull the trigger on it sharpish, because she's not getting any younger.
Millie Bobby Brown. She's at that age where it will become more noticeable faster.
Yeah, she's going to catch up with Carrie from A New Hope. So there's going to be a limited window of time where you're going to be able to get away with that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that she's the only option. I'm sure there are other young actresses out there that could fill that role of young Leia perfectly well. If you can find a story to tell that utilizes the character, I'd be on board with a recast of Leia in that respect, but not a replacement of Carrie. I don't think that's...
Yeah, that's the distinction. That's the distinction that I would make too. Mm. You know, I can deal with a previous retelling of an existing character. I can't countenance a replacement.
Yeah. I mean, I know some of the motivation behind the argument to recast is that the character should be bigger than the performer. That's fine in certain franchises, but you know, some of these things are somewhat untouchable. And with Leia, I think it'd be interesting, or I think it'd be appropriate to wrap up on a quote from Carrie Fisher where she said, "I am Leia. Leia is me."
Yeah,
it's like a Mobius striptease. They are. You hear me cross those names over repeatedly when we're talking about Carrie and Leia and Leia and Carrie. They're inseparable to me. I wouldn't accept even Meryl Streep. I just couldn't accept it. Just couldn't do it. It would call attention to itself and it would pull me out of the movie every moment. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, let's go back. Millie Bobby Brown, thumbs up. Go forward. I think we're done. What a shame.
Yeah,
but then, indeed. I think we've had the best Leia performance in Last Jedi. I think it's a perfect way to wrap that up. I think everything that needed to be said was said.
Yeah.
So we can probably leave it there.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Awesome. And so shall we leave this episode 2? That's it for episode 113 of Talk Star Wars. Thank you for joining us again this week. Rob, where can people find you on the internet between shows?
So the best place to find me is at Rob Wade Vision on Twitter and Instagram, and you can find everything I do there, including but not limited to Talk Star Wars and emotionally14.com.
Perfect. You can find everything I do at talkstarwars.co.uk and on Twitter at talkstarwars. There's a link, if you download the show notes, you can find a link in there, hyperlink to the network, the Star Wars Commonwealth Network, where you can check out all our partner shows. And there's a contact us button as well, where you can get the links to everybody that contributes on Talk Star Wars. That's it for us for another week. Have a good one, everybody. Keep an eye out for upcoming Twitter polls this week and your thoughts on the next hot topic, whatever that is, in the next 7 days. We'll pop into the show notes. Have a good week, everybody. I'll see you next
time. Bye-bye. Sorry.
Bye-bye-bye.
Bye-bye-bye.
Talk Star Wars is a proud member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Podcast Network. Find us at starwarscommonwealth.com alongside...
The Tumbling Saber Podcast.
The Generation X-Wing Podcast.
Rogue Squadron Podcast.
The TSW Roundtable.
The Skyhoppers Podcast.
The Nerdroom Podcast.
And San Diego Sabres Radio Podcast.
Head to starwarscommonwealth.com. Take your first steps to a larger world.
It's a wrap. It's a wrap.